The UN report points to a considerable rise in the number of Palestinians displaced by Israeli demolitions in the occupied East Al-Quds in August. U.S. fatalities from COVID-19 surpassed the threshold of 700,000, a toll roughly equivalent to the population of capital Washington, D.C. Italian riot police clashed with climate activists during a demonstration in the city of Milan. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. A UN report indicates that almost 100 Palestinians were displaced by the Israeli demolition drive in the occupied East Al-Quds in August. The figure published by the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs marks the highest number of displacement in Al-Quds in 1 month. It says 26 Palestinian homes were destroyed in August either by Israel or their owners. Israeli authorities destroy Palestinian homes in the occupied territories on a regular basis, citing pretexts, including a lack of building permits. Some Palestinians destroy their homes to avoid paying the cost if the process is done by the Israeli municipality. The demolition of Palestinian structures has made around 200 people homeless across the occupied West Bank this year. The Iranian foreign minister has slammed Bahrain for normalizing its ties with Israel and hosting the regime's foreign minister. In a Twitter post, Samir Abdullahian called Manama's move a flagrant treason against Palestinians and their cause. The top diplomat underlined the fact that Tel Aviv will only bring insecurity to Bahrain and the rest of the region. Reactions came a day after the Israeli foreign minister Yair Lapid visited Manama at the invitation of his Bahraini counterpart to inaugurate U.S. embassy there. Bahrain's main opposition group and people already denounced ties with Tel Aviv. The Persian Gulf Kingdom normalized relations with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. Russia has reported more than 25,200 new infections from COVID-19 in the past day, and the figure is the highest daily case tally in Russia since July. Total COVID infections are now about 7.4 million. On Saturday, Russia also logged 886 new deaths, and that brings its total fatalities to more than 208,000. COVID-19 has surged in Russia in the past few months, partly because of the Delta variant. The strain has given a surge of disease in the U.S. too. On Friday, total fatalities there surpassed the threshold of 700,000, and that's equivalent to the population of Washington, D.C. A Reuters tally indicating that global deaths from COVID-19 have passed the 5 million mark. Italian riot police have clashed with climate activists in the city of Milan. The activists were out on the streets of Milan for a second day in a row. They want swift action to tackle climate crisis. The Italian city is hosting meetings by energy and environment ministers from different countries. The meetings are taking place ahead of a UN climate conference set to open in Glasgow later this month. The event aims to secure more ambitious climate action from signatories of the 2015 Paris Agreement. Some 200 countries have signed that agreement that aims to limit global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Yellow vest protesters have taken to the streets of Paris to show their anger at rising energy prices in France. The protesters carry banners reading, "Small purchasing power equals empty fridges." Rising electricity bills and petrol prices in France have angered drivers too. They say the prices are reaching the 2 euro per liter mark and are putting pressure on their living costs.
You have to work hard to earn more than 100 euros a day. For me, I rent this car, which I pay 50 euros for. And for the remaining 50 euros, I have to eat. I have to fuel up with petrol. So that means I work all day to earn 50 euros. You see, if you raise petrol prices, that means we will not earn much. In the 50 euros that I earn, it will go to more petrol.
Earlier this week, the French finance minister said that rising energy prices will last a few more months. The country is trying to ease rising expenses for consumers by freezing natural gas and electricity prices on their bills. However, the French premier says the situation with petrol was different and it will be excluded from that plan. Energy costs are soaring in Europe due to supply and demand problems following last year's cold winter. October 2nd marks the anniversary of the killing of dissident Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. He was murdered at the kingdom's consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul. On the third anniversary of the murder, Khashoggi's widow has called on the United States to hold Riyadh accountable for the brutal killing. We've discussed that issue with our guests in our news review program.
The widow of the dissident Saudi journalist has called on the United States to hold Riyadh accountable for the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi at the kingdom's consulate in Istanbul 3 years ago.
MBS took Jamal from me and the entire world. Will you hold him accountable? Or will you reward his murderers? President Biden and Vice President Harris, when will you step up and fulfill your promises? When will you translate your words into action? Or will your administration continue business and as usual despite promising change?
Khashoggi's widow further described Khashoggi as someone who championed the rights of the Saudi people. She made the comments at a candlelit vigil held in Washington, D.C. to remember the slain journalist. In the ceremony, Hatice Cengiz also unveiled a large-scale portrait composed of Khashoggi's columns in the Washington Post. Elijah Magnier is a journalist and a political analyst joining us from Brussels. We also have Barry Grossman, who's an international lawyer, joining us from Bali, from Indonesia. Welcome to you both. Barry Grossman, first over to you. I'll throw the question that Khashoggi's fiancé has asked the U.S. to do, and that is, when will the U.S. step up and hold Saudi Arabia accountable for what has happened?
Well, I mean, I don't think that was a rhetorical question on her part, but I think the answer is obvious, and that is that the United States will not step up and will not hold Khashoggi, hold the KSA, and in particular Mohammed bin Salman, responsible for the brutal murder and butchering of Khashoggi. And for that matter, we might as well include the United Kingdom as well as embracing the same policy. And of course, the usual sprinkling of Gulf countries and other Arab countries. The fact of the matter is that President Biden has made it clear that while he claims he doesn't approve of what took place, that the United States has other priorities, and the priorities which he chooses to embrace as the incumbent president is to continue including the KSA as part of the United States' international protection racket in return for the KSA's commitment to take the fight to Iran, Yemen, and nations in the region. So it's simply not going to happen. And while I'm at it, I'd like to add, of course, this is one of those difficult cases where I think it's important to recognize that by any reasonable standard, Mr. Khashoggi was not a decent human being. He was, after all, an establishment insider in the Saudi regime. He was one of the leading voices calling for the war on Yemen before it actually started. Of course, subsequently, when he felt that his mentors were being targeted by Mohammed bin Salman, he went into exile, started writing for the Washington Post, and changed his tune very slightly, but remained ever critical of Iran for no particular reason. And in fact, even though he started speaking about leaving room for some secular opinion, right to the bitter end, he embraced what he saw as the Saudi Arabia identity as being a religious identity, as a Wahhabi Islamist revivalist state. You know, it's very difficult to get carried away with sympathy for him, apart from the fact that it was a brutal murder. It was completely unacceptable and really should be actioned. And we can contrast the failure to act on this with the position taken by Atlantic world countries like the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and certainly the United States, whenever the Russians are accused, rightfully or wrongfully, of assassinating one of their own that's become a double agent or a traitor to their national cause. Obviously, very different standards that apply, and certainly any reasonable person would say that Mohammed bin Salman should pay the price, but it's not going to happen.
Elijah McNair, looking at the third-year anniversary here, what are your thoughts, especially regarding the fact that obviously there's a murder that's taken place, or some may call it an assassination, and yet at this point all fingers point to Saudi Arabia, and yet nothing has been done about it?
Thank you for having me. Well, all the evidence pointed to Saudi Arabia, and above all, the U.S. intelligence report. And we understand that President Donald Trump was in bed with Saudi Arabia. However, with President Joe Biden in power, we see nothing have changed. And all the call from Biden administration about democracy of human rights, I think do not apply to Saudi Arabia. The U.S. National Security Advisor, Jack Sullivan, was in Riyadh in the last couple of days, and to indicate further the warm relationship between Saudi Arabia and the United States. And I don't think the U.S. wants to hold Mohammed bin Salman accountable for ordering and acknowledging and accepting and sending a death squad to Turkey to assassinate the Saudi journalist. This goes beyond an assassination. It is related to the deep relationship between Saudi Arabia and America that no U.S. administration is ready to question or to put in jeopardy. This is why we see that this is going to continue, and the death of Jamal Khashoggi is not expected to be questioned or held accountable anytime soon. That means that the Biden administration is not going to act to fulfill its commitment to human rights, and it's not going to satisfy the Khashoggi's wife request for justice.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Barry Grossman, international lawyer. Thank you, Elijah McNair, journalist and political analyst from Brussels. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
Now moving on, the Iran army has kicked off a massive drill in the country's northwestern border region. Senior generals say that the maneuver is a warning to foreign elements operating in the region and seeking to undermine the security of the Islamic Republic.
Iran's army ground forces on Friday launched a military exercise in the northwestern region close to the borders with Azerbaijan and Armenia. Artillery, drone, and electronic warfare units with aerial support from the Army's Airborne Division are participating in the exercise. The drill is codenamed Conquerors of Khaybar, a reference to the 7th century Battle of Khaybar, in which Prophet Muhammad and his army of early Muslims foiled a plot hatched by Jewish tribes. Iran's Army Ground Forces commander, Brigadier General Kumars Haydari, who is leading the drills, says his country will not tolerate the presence of Israeli elements or terrorists in the region.
We respect the sovereignty of all countries, including our neighbors, but are strongly against the presence of the Zionist regime as well as the Daesh terrorists.
Iran has long voiced concern over what it calls the presence of Israeli elements and terrorists near its northwestern borders. Tehran says the terrorists assembled there at the invitation of a regional state at the height of a 2020 conflict between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Iran particularly accuses Israel of hatching plots in order to sow discord among Muslim nations, saying the regime sees its survival through creating insecurity. Some analysts say the drills send a clear and powerful message to other countries against any acts that challenge Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity.
This one here in the Northwest is very significant because it's sending out a clear message that Iran is not going to be passive. They're going to proactively be hunting and seeking out any forces which are trying to violate the stability of the Islamic Republic of Iran. And don't forget, it's been done because the Azerbaijani themselves have talked about a southern Azerbaijan, referring to the Iranian territories, which are the province of Azerbaijan, as essentially theirs. Now, this is something the Israelis, I'm sure, can stoke up really quite a lot in terms of trying to create division and fragmentation.
Moreover, General Haidari also made it clear that the Islamic Republic will not tolerate any change to the official borders. He stressed that the transit routes in the region should remain safe and secure, and that all the regional countries should respect the flow of trade and energy through their borders. Last week, Iran's Islamic Revolution's Guard Corps held a separate military exercise in the northwestern province of Ardabil. The drill drew criticism from Azerbaijan's President Ilham Aliyev, who said he was surprised by Iran's decision since it hadn't held maneuvers in the region for about three decades. Iran's foreign ministry, however, reacted to Aliyev's remarks, saying the drills was meant to secure regional peace and security.
Now in Georgia, people are casting their ballots in local elections amid a political standoff between the ruling party and the opposition over the arrest of former President Mikhail Saakashvili. Some 3.5 million people are eligible to vote. The polls are held for local self-government bodies, where mayors and city councils will be chosen for four-year term. On Friday, police detained Saakashvili, who had flown back home from Ukraine and was campaigning for the main opposition party, the United National Movement. Saakashvili left Georgia in 2013. He was later convicted in absentia on charges of abuse of power. He was sentenced to 6 years behind bars. Authorities accuse him of deliberately trying to destabilize the country. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
U.S. Congress passed a bill to fund the government into December, but questions remain over the debt ceiling and President Joe Biden's agenda. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Government Avoided a Shutdown, But What Happens Next?" The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The U.S. government went into Thursday, 30th of September, embroiled in a game of three-dimensional chess, with time running out and trillions of dollars at stake. The first dimension was a must-do, fund the government by midnight to avoid it shutting down. In a typical shutdown, hundreds of thousands of federal employees stop getting paid, and many stop working. Some services are suspended, and numerous national attractions and national parks temporarily close. The second dimension is an even bigger must-do, raise the national debt ceiling, an artificially imposed borrowing limit before an estimated deadline of 18th of October. Failure to pay its bills would see the U.S. default for the first time in history. The House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has warned that the effects would be cataclysmic and cost 6 million jobs. The third dimension is not quite a must, but it feels that way to Joe Biden and the Democrats. Pass a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill and a $3.5 trillion partisan package that expands social services and tackles the climate crisis. Both are stalled by divisions between Democratic centrists and progressives, along with Republican eagerness to deny President Biden a win. The U.S. government's power is spread across the executive, the president, legislative, that means Congress, and judicial, or Supreme Court and other court branches, which ensures checks and balances, but can also get messy quickly. While Democrats hold the presidency and both chambers of Congress, their margins in the latter are razor thin. The Senate is evenly split 50-50, with the Vice President Kamala Harris holding the tiebreaker vote. Democrats have a 220 to 212 margin in the House of Representatives, so can only afford a handful of defections. Comparisons between President Biden and Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal in the 1930s were therefore somewhat fanciful, since Roosevelt enjoyed much more comfortable majorities to rubber-stamp his priorities. Joe Biden has the power of persuasion, but not much else. So first things first, will the government shut down at midnight? No, so breathe a sigh of relief. Congress avoided a partial federal shutdown on Thursday, 30th of September, when the Senate and House passed the bill to keep the government funded through to 3rd of December. The stopgap spending bill, which prevented the first shutdown since late 2018, early 2019, provides aid for communities hard hit by hurricanes, wildfires, and other natural disasters, as well as money to help Afghan refugees. But it came at a price, as Democrats were forced to remove language from the bill that would have raised the debt ceiling. Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, said on Thursday, 30th of September, "Just as our Republican colleagues realized that a government shutdown would be catastrophic, they should realize that a default on the national debt would be even worse." Experts predict that the United States would plunge into an instant recession, millions of jobs would be lost, interest rates would soar high, and the stock market would plummet. Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's Analytics, told CNN, "It will be financial Armageddon. It's complete craziness to even contemplate the idea of not paying our debt on time. This nightmare, akin to a person running up charges on a credit card and then refusing to pay, can be avoided by giving the Treasury Department additional borrowing authority beyond the current statutory limit of $28.4 trillion. But Senator Mitch McConnell has argued that since Democrats control Congress and the White House, they should pass a debt limit extension with the same budgetary tools they're using to try to pass the $3.5 trillion social and environmental package. Democrats contend this is rank hypocrisy, since the move would cover spending that Congress has already approved, not future investments. Historically, both parties have voted to raise the limit, and Democrats joined the Republican Senate majority in doing so three times during Donald Trump's presidency. Late on Wednesday, 29th of September, the House approved a bill suspending the debt limit through December 2022, but it is expected to be blocked by Senate Republicans. That would mean the threat of default continues to loom. Conventional wisdom holds that the politicians would not surely be willing to drive the country off a cliff, or would they? This is a cornerstone of the Biden agenda, investing $1 trillion in roads, railways, bridges, ports, airports, broadband, internet, and more. On Thursday, 30th of September, the House delayed a scheduled vote on the infrastructure bill that passed the Senate last month in a bipartisan vote, with 19 Republicans voting yes. But since then, House Republicans have been backing away from the bill in a move to deny President Biden a victory. Nancy Pelosi also faces a revolt from an influential group of progressive Democrats who warned she must hold it back until a bigger, $3.5 trillion social and environmental investment bill is nailed down. The progressives want Nancy Pelosi to stand by earlier statements that both bills would move through Congress together. They fear that once centrist Democrats have infrastructure in the bag, they will go cold on the bigger commitment. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a leader of the House Progressive, said, "We're not blindly trusting that these bills are going to get done in the Senate without actually having that be guaranteed. It is unlikely that Nancy Pelosi will go ahead with the vote unless she's assured of victory." The House Speaker has postponed negotiations until coming days, giving Democrats at least another chance to break the impasse. This would be a once-in-a-generation investment, drawing a line under 40 years of Ronald Reagan's trickle-down economics and potentially transforming millions of lives. The proposed legislation would extend the child tax credit, establish universal pre-K education, and create a federally paid family and medical leave system. It also contains an array of programs to combat the climate crisis and move the country towards renewable energy. The $3.5 trillion plan over 10 years will be paid for by tax increases on the wealthiest Americans and wealthiest corporations. But centrists are pushing for a smaller package, and negotiations on it could stretch for weeks or even longer. It could pass the Senate without Republican votes, though through a process known as reconciliation, but two Democratic senators stand in the way. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona objected a price tag. Senator Manchin said on Wednesday, 29th of September, that spending so much at a time of inflation and a ballooning national debt was the definition of fiscal insanity. President Biden has lobbied both senators, but neither has publicly made clear exactly what they want, much to the frustration of progressives. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, chair of the House Progressive Caucus, said they need to come up with a counteroffer and then we sit down and negotiate from there. Senator Joe Manchin indicated to reporters on Thursday that he would settle for about a $1.5 trillion, less than half the progressive demands and unlikely to fly. So the stalemate continues. Never bet against Nancy Pelosi, who pulled off Barack Obama's Affordable Care Act despite internal divisions. But if it does all go wrong, it would be a political disaster for Democrats in general and for President Biden in particular, crashing the Build Back Better agenda on which he ran for re-election against Donald Trump last year. It would also be likely to fuel the sentiment that Washington politicians cannot get anything done. Analysts have warned that Democrats would face a landslide defeat in the midterm elections in November next year, and that President Biden's bid for re-election in 2024 would lie in tatters. His presidency would be all but sunk.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Tonight, inshallah, we want to spend some time learning from Imam Sajjad, salamullahi alayh. The Tawaghit, when they notice something very important happens, events happen in history, what they want to do is they like to rewrite history. If you don't tell what happened, if you don't say the haqa'iq again and again, if you don't repeat them, they will produce a revisionist form of history. People will forget who was the hero, who was the villain. I know many of you probably watched, at least you saw some of the highlights of the debate. I don't know how many of us noticed that Pence, Mike Pence, he went over, he mentioned Qasem Soleimani. He painted him to be a terrorist. This just happened. Who fought against ISIS? Who destroyed them? Who sacrificed? What do? I paint him in front of everybody. I repaint the picture for you. I'll tell history. If you leave me, I will retell history for you. I'll make sure the villain is the hero. So what did the Imam do? Brothers and sisters, I'd like to say it this way, this lesson in this way. The Imam shed revolutionary tears that ignited a revolution. For years, according to some ahadith, 40 years, our Imam would cry about what happened. How would he teach us this story? Sometimes recounting the event. They tell the story about how the Imam did this. You would bring the Imam food. The Imam would see that water is offered. What happened to my father? The Imam would cry. People would complain. His own servants, they're like, why are you crying this much? The Imam would explain. Quranic parallels. Nabi Yaqub, he knew Yusuf was alive. How long did he lose it? How long did he cry? How big of an event was this? He had to reestablish this. He would tell the details. This is how he's keeping it alive. Telling the event, retelling the event. Remember, it's like Malcolm X said. He said, if you're not careful, the newspapers will have you believing, have you hating the oppressed and loving the oppressors. Once the leader was speaking, he said that he was quoting a lesson from one of our greats. He said that once one of our greats was asked, they said, why is it that you tell the story of Karbala with so much detail, Imam Hussein, what happened, so much importance on it? He said, we learned our lesson with Khadir. We're not going to let you do that with Karbala. So retelling the event, at every opportunity, the Imam would go over, explain again and again, crying, weeping, stories, the grandson of the Prophet. His job is to make sure that Karbala stays in the minds and the hearts of the believers forever. Now, even if they wanted to erase Karbala from the hearts of the people, they can't. Now it's a reality. But that's that jihad of our Imam. So I want to mention something else too, though, but I do want to keep this important because some of us, meaning you and I, we have the tawfiq of recounting this story. We have to make sure we share the story to our children and grandchildren accurately. What happened? Non-Muslims, others! Our next lesson that we want to learn from our Imam is a lesson of ideological bravery in captivity. We're talking now about Arba'een. And there's a discussion in history. Was it 40 days after that they returned or a year later? That's not important. What the Imam was doing was important. Keeping the memory of Karbala alive. How did he do that? Well, one of the things that the Imam did is that this stage, the captivity of the Imam, is different from the entire life of the Imam. For the majority of the Imam, and he was our Imam, maybe 35, maybe more years than that. For the majority of the Imam's life, he's doing taqiyya. He's quiet. He's sometimes interacting with the tawaghit. He's doing the infrastructural work. The plan is, by the time of Imam Sadiq, the qiyam will happen. Sometimes even sitting with Abdullah bin Marwan. Sometimes, if that's what it takes. So what happens? Well, Abdul Malik bin Marwan. So what happens is, but now, during the captivity, you see a completely different side of the Imam. Ideological bravery in captivity. At the time when the Imam has no supporters, in chains, being paraded through the cities, the threat was his women, the daughters of the Prophet, they can be taken as slave girls. At this stage, you see that our Imam is so ferocious. The rest of his life, quiet, doing his work, but now when he's at his weakest, he's the most ferocious. They bring him into the courtyard of Ubaidullah, chained. Remember, Ubaidullah just finished massacring his father. He says, "Who are you?" He says, "I'm Ali, the son of Hussein. I thought they killed Ali." He explains. The Imam is so forceful there. Ubaidullah gets taken aback. When he threatens him, the Imam doesn't hold any punches. In the courtyard of Ubaidullah, nothing, surrounded, chains. He explains the true position of Ahlul Bayt when it comes to the tawaghit. He's like, "Do you threaten us with death? Killing us is ada. We're used to that. Martyrdom is karama for us at this stage." Later, they're marching them from city to city. They bring him in front of Yazid. You would think the head of your father is there, beating the head with the sticks. You have nothing. There, the Imam tells Yazid. He's like, "Do you allow me to go on these sticks, these pieces of wood, and address the people?" At this stage, Yazid thinks, "We've got him broken. We've beaten this guy. He's a prisoner, we've captured him, we're parading him, we're disrespecting his father. The Ahlul Bayt have nothing left." Yazid is so arrogant at this stage, he's mocking Islam. There was no information from the heavens. He thinks he has it. Then he sees Imam Sajjad. Oh, when the Imam goes, the lecture the Imam gives, in Sham, they wanted to revolt. He explains, "Imama, why did his father die? What happened in Karbala? Who am I?" The sheer bravery of the Imam when he has nothing. And of course, even that part of it is a lesson for us. As Amir al-Mu'mineen tells us, he says, "Al-mawtu fi hayatikum maqhurin." Death is when you die, you're alive, humiliated. When you're a slave, but you're alive. He says, "Walhayatu fi mautikum qahirin." Life is standing for your principles, even if you're killed. Now, what was the Imam doing, though? Because I said this was very different from every other part of the Imam's life. The Imam has to make sure the blood of the martyrs doesn't go in vain. He created so much noise. He was so ferocious when it came to Yazid. They didn't want to touch him. Rulers after didn't want to touch Imam Sajjad. What is he doing? The blood of the martyrs is not going in vain. He needs to harness those emotions, prepare for the long term. The masses need to be awakened. Who did what to whom? So the Imam took this opportunity and he lit them on fire. Ideological bravery from our Imam. Now, later on, for the rest of the life of the Imam, then our Imam is, he's quiet, He already explained his true position to the Tawarit. He's planning. He's doing that infrastructural work. At the time I mentioned before, by the time of his blood, sweat, and tears, by the time of Imam Baqir, people are now gathered around the Imam. They are able to openly teach the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. By the time when Bani Umayyah is weak, the time of Imam Sadiq, that's when the time when the mission was going to be over. If the people had done their responsibility, if the Shia hadn't failed him.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Adi Alimun Halim Hakimun Mati. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, said net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and companies are taking bold action to cut greenhouse gas emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it. We have prepared for you an article written by Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, Oxfam Warns Reforestation Hopes Threaten Global Food Security. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Charity Oxfam has warned governments and businesses hoping to plant trees and restore forests in order to reach net zero emissions must sharply limit such efforts to avoid driving up food prices in the developing world. According to a report titled Tightening the Net, Net Zero Climate Targets, Implications for Land and Food Equity, planting trees has been mooted as one of the key ways of tackling the climate crisis. But the amount of land needed for such forests would be vast, and planting even a fraction of the area needed to offset global greenhouse gas emissions would encroach on the land needed for crops to feed a growing population. At least 1.6 billion hectares of land, an area five times the size of India, equivalent to all the land now farmed on the planet, would be required to reach net zero emissions for the planet by 2050, via tree planting alone. While no one is suggesting planting trees to that extent, the report's author said it gave an idea of the scale of the planting required and how limited offsetting should be if food price rises are to be avoided. Nafkoti Dabi, climate policy lead at Oxfam and co-author of the report, explained, "It is difficult to tell how much land will be required as governments have not been transparent about how they plan to meet their net zero commitments. But many countries and companies are talking about afforestation and reforestation. And the first question is, where is this land going to come from? According to some estimates, food prices could rise by as much as 80% by 2050 if offsetting emissions through forestry is overused. About 350 million hectares of land, an area roughly the size of India, could be used for offsetting without disrupting agriculture around the world. But taken together, the plans for offsetting the countries and companies around the world could soon exceed this. Nafkoti Dabi said, "Already hundreds of millions of people around the world are going hungry. We need to consult countries on how they're going to use their land, and countries and companies need to reduce their emissions first before relying on offsetting. We also need to reduce emissions from agriculture, which is the second biggest source of emissions globally." The report also found that two of the most commonly used offsetting measures, that is reforestation and the planting of new forests, were among the worst at putting food security at risk. According to the analysis, far better were nature-based solutions that focused on forest management, agroforestry, the practice of combining crop cultivation or pasture with growing trees, as well as pasture management and soil management in croplands. These would allow people to use the land for food while sequestering carbon. Darby explained, "We are not against afforestation and reforestation, and we do not want to stop people doing these things, but they should not be used at a large scale and should be combined with other methods, such as agroforestry." She gave the example of Switzerland, which is planning to offset about 12.5% of its greenhouse gas emissions through carbon credits from projects in other countries, including Peru and Ghana. Oxfam estimated to reach that target would take an area the size of Costa Rica. Some companies are also planning to use carbon offsetting based on trees and land as part of their efforts to reach net zero emissions. Oxfam found that many of these plans, taken together, could amount to an overuse of land. For instance, four leading energy companies would require an area twice the size of the United Kingdom for their offsetting. According to Oxfam's estimates, Shell would need about 28.6 million hectares of land by 2050, while Total Energy plans to offset about 7% of its emissions, needing about 2.6 million hectares of land by 2050. Eni, another energy company, has plans for 8 million hectares of forestry, but Oxfam calculates that double this could be needed. BP has not set out its plans in detail, but Oxfam estimates it is likely to require as much as 22.5 million hectares of land for offsetting as much as 15% of its emissions. Danny Sriskandaraja, chief executive of Oxfam, called for companies and governments to cut their emissions drastically rather than relying on offsets. He said, "Too many companies and too many governments are hiding behind the smokescreen of net zero emissions to continue dirty business as usual activities. A prime example of the doublethink we are seeing is the oil and gas sector trying to justify its ongoing extraction of fossil fuels by promising unrealistic carbon removal schemes that require ludicrous amounts of land." He added, "Net zero targets are vital to tackling climate change. Some governments and some companies are taking bold action to cut emissions, but there are currently too few to give us a realistic chance of averting climate catastrophe and the widespread hunger and devastation that come with it. A spokesperson for British Petroleum BP said, BP does not intend to rely on offsets to meet either our 2025 emissions reduction targets or 2030 aims. However, they may help us to go beyond those aims if we can. We do support the use of carbon offsets or credits by companies, countries, and society to achieve faster and lower cost pathways to net zero emissions and help meet the Paris climate goals. Shell said it did not recognize Oxfam's estimates. A spokesperson said meeting a net zero target requires fundamentally changing the forms of energy Shell supplies and then using offsets at the margin to compensate for any remaining emissions. That is, we're changing the products that we sell. The spokesperson for Shell added, as Shell shifts its portfolio to more and more renewable and low-carbon sources of energy, it could well be that the emissions associated with energy sold by Shell in 2050 is less than the quantity of carbon credits we expect to be able to supply our customers in 2030.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
February 27th, 2021. A leader in the true sense of the word. If the conditions in Medina after the demise of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, and the events that took place are explained to us correctly, and if we can gain a correct understanding of this matter, we will understand what a great movement Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, launched. Of all the companions of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, only 10 or 12 individuals were willing to stand up in the mosque to defend the right of the commander of the faithful, peace be upon him. Under those circumstances, the Holy Prophet's daughter, peace be upon her, delivered that eloquent sermon and that astonishing address in which she addressed certain truths. Another sermon that she delivered was the one which she addressed to the women of Medina when she was ill in bed. These things are not related to the spiritual attributes of that great personality. Rather, they are related to those attributes of hers that are understandable to us. We can understand these attributes with an ordinary, reasonable outlook. However, they are so significant that they cannot be measured. In other words, they are not comparable to any other self-sacrificing act. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Her young husband was constantly at the battlefront and in the battlefield. However, in spite of the problems in the environment and in life, Fatimah al-Zahra, peace be upon her, was like a focal point for the people and Muslims to refer to. She was the Prophet's daughter who solved problems, and under these conditions, she led an honorable life. Even in times of conquests and the coming of spoils of war, the Prophet's daughter did not allow the minutest of worldly pleasures and luxuries and the things that attract the hearts of young girls to enter her heart. When the Prophet sent a destitute old man to the door of the house of the Commander of the Faithful, telling him, "Go and ask them for your needs," Fatimah al-Zahra, peace be upon her, gave him the leather hide on which Hassan and Hussein slept and which was as a ground cloth for her children, because she had nothing else in the house. She told him, "Sell it and use the money from it."
Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.